Hello, and welcome to another edition of the award-winning Sight into Sound Presents. On this edition of Sight into Sound Presents, we will talk to Mary Harper. Mary is the author of a book titled The Sound of Her Voice, My Blind Parents' Story. Mary will discuss the inspirational and remarkable life that her parents led, raising four children without the ability to see. The Sound of Her Voice, My Blind Parents' Story, will also soon be heard on Sight into Sound's Morning Book Hour. That's Mary Harper, coming up on Sight into Sound Presents. I'm Jim Bratton. Hi, this is Jim Bratton, and this is Sight into Sound Presents. Today we're talking to Mary Harper, and she is the author of a book called The Sound of Her Voice. Very intriguing name, and from what I've had in terms of our conversations, a very intriguing background that you have. Thank you very, very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Mary, walk me through a little bit about your parents.
Okay. Both of my parents were born within like 3 months of each other in 1913, 1914. And at that time, they were immediately recognized as having a problem with their eyes. And they eventually were diagnosed with glaucoma. They both had some vision. My father ended up losing his completely at age four. And that's a rather traumatic story that's in the book. My mother had a more gradual decline in her vision, and she finally lost her sight at age 11. So she had memories of colors, whereas my father knows intellectually that red is a fire truck or red, you know, he knows intellectually that trees are green, but I don't think he really understands what that color is.
So colors were never defined for your dad as colors, but rather as objects to be identified by a color?
You ask him his memory of anything that he could see. And his earliest memory is of they lived across the street from the train tracks, and that's where the sidings were, I guess. And so coal cars would be parked there. And in the wintertime, he remembered seeing black coal and white snow on top of the black coal. That's the only thing he had for a color memory, even though he's very smart and
yes,
knew intellectually that colors were colors and so forth. But he had no real, I think, idea of or memory of color. But my mom did. She knew what with everything, and she I had no problem with helping us to get dressed. Skipping ahead now in the story, my parents were eventually found their way to the Indiana School for the Blind and met in 1925 in the fourth grade. So this is also a love story, how they overcame many, many obstacles, both from society, family, and within themselves, trying to persevere. Because by the time they finished high school, they were in love, but my mother said, absolutely, I will not marry you until you can prove to me that you can support me. They did not want to get married and be dependent on any kind of family or any kind of welfare. So dad got busy, and he went, they both went to Ball State Teachers College back then. That was called Ball State Teachers College. Now it's Ball State University. Mom said, oh, I just wanted an education. And my dad said, oh, I wanted an education. And then he went on to law school. He was the first blind graduate of Notre Dame Law School. And once he got out, he had an older brother who was also a graduate of the law school there, and they began practicing law together. Within a year or so, he convinced my mother to marry him, that he could support her and family. And so that's what he did for his career. He was an attorney, and then he got busy with politics and loved politics and was elected judge three different times. So he was pretty prominent in Muncie, Indiana. Everybody knew my dad, who was, you know, a blind guy with a seeing eye dog. Everybody knew who he was, which he wrote in his papers a lot.
So you were from a high-profile family that,
yes,
even though were not sighted, still maintained positions of leadership in the community. That's pretty early on for that.
Yes. My dad was always wanting to give back to the community. He gave so many talks, not only on it was kind of back in the day, you could read little newspaper articles about Mario Perrone speaks to, and his dog Carla, spoke to the Boy Scout troop number 25 at such and such church about seeing eye dogs and being blind. So that would be news in those days. So
yeah, no, I understand.
In the news, yeah. So, yes, he would do a lot of those kind of talks. But then he got busy with crippled children, and Baptist Easter Seals were really a big deal. He was president of the Easter Seal Society and of Indiana, and also locally. My mother was much more quiet, more introverted, and she stayed home, but she raised four kids pretty much by herself. So but Dad was pretty busy in the evenings. And I know Mom sometimes would complain, but he would wish that he would stay home a little bit more, but he was out.
You know, I'd like to go back to something early on when you were talking about the contrast between the black coal and the white snow and the sound of the trains coming by on the sidings or the sounds of the coal cars on the siding.
Yes.
And that limited identification of colors. Did your dad end up identifying colors with certain sounds throughout his life then?
That's a great question, and I never thought to ask. He never really said much, but he was very, very, of course, very, very interested in sounds and taught me bird songs and to listen to birds and to I'll hear the wind. But as far as matching them up with colors, no, not so much that I can remember anyway.
But ambient was important.
Oh, yes. Incredibly important.
You know, it's a bit ironic now that there's an entire genre of music and recorded sound that's geared toward the relaxation and stimulus of ambient sound. I mean, it's a big deal now. You were brought up with that as a big deal all the way through your life then.
I was. It was interesting. I was out bird watching with a friend and I said, "Oh, listen to that." And she just wouldn't shut up talking. And I was just like, "I'm getting frustrated with you because I want to listen to this bird." Oh, well, it never occurred to her to listen to birds. She just was focused on visual. So for me, I also listen a lot. I listen to people's voices. I can tell a lot about people just by listening to their voice. And my father was very good at that, too, because, you know, when he was city court judge, he had to determine if a person was guilty or not. And he had several tricks up his sleeve that he was able to use. And there's some fun stories that I put in the book about my dad and how he was able to manage being a blind judge.
Would you share a couple of those? Because this whole thing about an acoustic lie detector is incredibly intriguing.
Yeah. Well, one of the things he did was to insist that the witness chair never be oiled. So it always would be sort of squeaky. And usually a person who was really guilty would move around a little bit more. In other words, that would be a red flag for him. And of course, he would take into account other evidence. But if the guy was moving around a lot, chances are he's nervous and wanting to hide something. My dad relied also on bailiffs. He had a bailiff, of course, sighted bailiff, who my dad, if he had any questions, would say, "What does the guy look like? What was his expression?" That kind of thing. But and then, of course, he took notes in Braille. And he had another one. He had a seeing-eye dog, of course, and the dog would be with him underneath the bench, just sitting there doing his thing, being a dog. The rumor around the jailhouse was that, well, if you want to find out if you're going to be guilty or not, just look at the dog's tail. If the dog's tail is going up and down a lot, then you're guilty. My dad just laughed and laughed at that because, you know, that's absolutely not true. But that was a story going wrong, too.
You know, I'm not so sure that the dog's wagging tail was completely legend. Don't you think that might have had something to do with fact, and that's how it got started?
You know, I wasn't around then, so I can't say for sure how it got started. I can only go by the story my dad told me. But, you know, he didn't believe that. He just laughed at it. So I realized that in Britain, where I said he created two questions to assess the defendant's honesty. Did what the accused had to say make any sense? And what was his physical reaction? Because Mario knew that if a person had nothing to hide, he'd generally open his mouth and speak clearly. Yeah. A dishonest defendant usually wouldn't look directly at the judge, instead turning his head away or looking down. And Mario could tell by the way his voice was coming from what he was doing.
Could he tell by the tone and the timbre and say the vibrato or whatever, the hesitation or the sound or the tightening of the throat or any of those subtle things that might go unnoticed if you weren't a student of sound?
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. He was a master of that. He can tell. One time we were visiting somebody, we left, came back, and he was in the car, and he says, "So, Mary, tell me, is she a loser? That woman just seemed like a loser to me." I'm like, yeah. And I'm going to explain her life story. It's really sort of sad. But my dad was so perceptive. He could pick up on all kinds of things that most people, just by looking at someone, wouldn't be able to tell.
How about as a politician, if not a politician, as a a public servant, let's say, or somebody who would have to face election periodically, what was it like to watch him work a room when he was campaigning?
You know, I was a kid.
Yeah.
And it was very different for me because I'm like, well, there's Dad. And I didn't often accompany him to a lot of campaign events. He did those usually on his own or with some friends or whatever. But there would be times I can remember that because he knew so many people, some of them would die. And so when I got my driver's license, he'd say, "Mary, would you take me down to the funeral home? I got to pay respects to so-and-so." I'm like, okay. He knew everybody in the room, or they would come up to him and don't want to shake his hand. And he would remember people. That was one of his gifts, that he recognized many, many voices. In fact, way back in the late 30s, when he was in school at Notre Dame, there was an article, a newspaper article, and a picture taken of him shaking hands with somebody. And the caption was, "Blind man knows 150 voices." And the thing was that he supposedly knew most everybody in his class just by their voice. So that was amazing. And then that he kept that reputation up all his life because people would come up to him and say, "Hi, Mario, do you know who this is?"
Oh, golly bum.
And that would, I could see he was not happy to have that. And a lot of times he would remember the name, but other times he would say something like, "Well, I'm so sorry, I don't really remember your voice," or something. But it's just awkward. I mean, don't do that.
Who does that?
People, I think that's also part of what my mission is right now, is to educate people about how do you treat a blind person? Because there's so many people that don't know. And sometimes it's just nice to be able to call up somebody who that you know may has problems with their vision. Don't have to be necessarily completely blind. There's a lot of folks out there with vision issues that can't drive. We call them up, say, "Would you let me take you to the grocery? Do you want to get out for lunch? Do you want to do something?" People don't think to do that. And I think that was the hardest thing for my parents, because by golly, they were not going to call somebody and say, "Hey, could we go out to lunch?" They would wait for someone to call them. So it's hard, and you can be isolated too, because you can't make eye contact with people. And it's what I say in my book, you know, if you can't see a person, how do you fall in love? Normally you would see their smile or the twinkle in their eyes or how they walk or whatever. But a blind person can't see all that. And that hence the title of the book. It's The Sound of Her Voice.
Yeah.
That is what attracted my dad at the very, very beginning.
Tell me a little bit more about that. We've dwelled on the skills and the additional almost senses that your dad developed. Your mom was running the house all this time. She had to develop her own way of doing things. And there's some danger involved in running a household.
There is. And that's part of her struggle and persistence. Because in School for the Blind, when they were teenagers, they were the women anyway, were taught how to cook. She sewed some. She could sew on a button. She could make a hem. She could do all kinds of things with her hands. But she was not taught mobility training, whereas the boys were. So boys were free to go on the bus and do whatever they wanted and have a good time and on weekends. And the girls had to be accompanied by someone. And they were not. So my mother never went anywhere by herself. She didn't even walk next door to visit my grandparents by herself. She was fine inside the house, in the yard. She was absolutely fine, but going anywhere else, no, she couldn't do it.
Was she able to break through that ultimately or not?
No, didn't want to. Yeah. And people said, well, does she have a seeing eye dog? Nope, she didn't want a seeing eye dog. She was happy doing the stuff that she was doing in the house. And she said she took care of the house and Mario took care of everything else outside and earned the living. And of course, this was in the 40s and 50s and 60s. And that was true for a lot of people. For her, it was comfortable to stay at home, but she had overcome a lot of naysayers. Her mother wouldn't let her in the kitchen to practice her cooking skills. Oh, no, it's too dangerous. You might get hurt. And then when she married, my mother and father had to live with his parents, who were, by the way, Italian immigrants, first generation Italian immigrants. And if you know anything about stereotypical Italian mothers, they love their son. And it's very hard for a daughter-in-law to live with a mother-in-law who wants to spoil your husband. And she was also telling my mother, oh, you can't do this, you can't do that. My mother would try and say, well, let me at least do the laundry. Oh, no, you can't see. So how could you possibly do the laundry? So people close to her have been telling her, no, you can't do this, can't do that. Then when they finally got their own apartment, she basically taught herself how to cook. She set up the apartment. She figured out how to raise a child. She hadn't even been really around many kids. I was thinking, you know, her sisters had children, but they didn't live close by. So it wasn't like she saw people on that everyday basis and learned how to become a mother, you know. She did a lot of reading. She had a Braille recipe book, which I still have. She just basically taught herself how to do everything. And back then, it was not easy. When I had my first child and I thought, oh, my God, how did my mother ever change our diapers? Because back then it was cloth diapers that she washed herself.
Yes.
Yeah. And I asked her one time, I said, Mom, how did you do that? And she said, well, I put my fingers between the baby and the diaper pin and I then put the pin in, and I said, oh, my God, didn't you poke yourself? She said, oh, yeah, all the time I did, but I never wanted to poke the baby. So, you know, bless her. She was so strong and so determined. And then, yeah, to raise four kids, there's 10 years between us. So Anne was born when my mother was 30, and I was born when my mother was 40, which I can't imagine it.
Well, the story of your mother is just, as I hear it, is just inspirational.
Right.
You have to be just incredibly proud.
And both of them wanted to learn. They were lifelong learners. So they were always reading, always listening to the news, always on the radio, NPR, or whatever. And they had talking books, of course. My mom loved talking books. I'd come home from school, and it'd be real quiet in there, and except for a droning voice that was, back then they were just droning on about da da da. And I'd come in and I'd find my mother sound asleep. I'd come in and I said, Mom, and she'd say, Oh, is it 2:30 already? I said, yeah. And she said, oh, I must have fallen asleep. So I said, well, but you lost your place now. And she fall asleep. She said, it doesn't matter. I just put the needle back because that's who's a record player.
The needle back, yes.
Yeah. So she said, I just put the needle back and I re listened to it.
As the offspring in that, or a offspring in that home environment, what kind of respect did it create in you and for people who might not have some of the same advantages of perception of their environment?
We were taught from a very early age how to walk with our parents and stopping at curbs and listening for traffic and looking for traffic, of course. And they trusted us from a very early age. And the same way it was driving, which I would never sit in a car with my eyes closed while my kids were driving. My dad trusted me when I was 16. I was driving down the road. And he said, now, Mary, aren't you going just a little fast? I'm like, oh, sorry. He knew, he could tell.
Oh, yeah, of course he could. He might not have been able to see, but he knew to be afraid. So,
well, he often knew the streets of Muncie, Indiana, backwards and forwards, because one day he was out waiting for a bus to go to work. Guy came along and said, hey, Mario, you want to ride? He said, sure. So you get in the car and they were talking away, having a fine time. And apparently, presently, my dad says, hey, Fred, don't you think you're going the wrong way on this one-way street? And he said, oh, my God. And he was. He said, oh, you're like, oh my, how did a blind man know that they were going the wrong way on a one-way street? And that was just amazed the driver so much. He went and told his friend he was a reporter for the local newspaper. And of course, it made the local newspaper, but then it got picked up by the wires. So I had found clippings from all over the country. Blind man knows when car's going the wrong way.
Oh, that's great. A beautiful story. And what led you to write the book then?
You know, as I got older, I realized there's so many wonderful stories that I just didn't want them to get lost. My parents were such special people. I was actually thinking more of writing a memoir about what it was like to grow up with blind parents. And I realized, story's not about me. Story's about them and what they overcome, came, and the adventures they both had when they were young. Yeah, my dad hiking in the Alps of Italy and almost falling to his death a couple of times. And my mother climbing on the structure of a barn that was still being built and other things. I mean, they were fearless. So I knew I had to write those down and keep them. So I had them all in place and then for my grandchildren. And I realized, well, other people seem to really enjoy the story. So maybe I'd get it published.
And it sounds like, besides the riding, while you were learning to drive, that your dad would ride on a tandem bike with you as well?
Oh, sure. As soon as my legs were long enough, I would ride the bike. I'd be in the front and he'd be in the back and he'd be pumping away and I would be driving. And that would be, I think, almost would be more scary than being in a car, because if you fall, you almost guaranteed to get pretty bruised up.
And that your mother could develop the skill where she could sense when your hand was in the cookie jar?
Because my mom was in the kitchen cooking and she was frying something, was making enough noise that I thought, I can just climb up on the counter and get in there and get me a cookie before dinner. But she heard me, and I'm like, oh, how did she hear me? Mary, what's in your mouth? Nothing. As there is too. What are you eating? And we couldn't get away with much, that's for sure.
It sure sounds like it. Were there surprises as the book came together for you?
Yes. I was doing a lot of research, and while I was doing research, we were realizing, oh, that's why Mom never went next door to be with my mother, our grandmother. I learned a lot more about the family dynamics, and my oldest sister, who was 10 years older than me, helped a lot with that, because she was, you know, when she was, you know, maybe 13, 14, whatever, and I'm just 3 or 4 years old, so I wouldn't have the understanding that she did. So she would tell me these stories about what happened between my mother and her mother-in-law. And it was difficult for my mom. She was always, both of my parents, but especially my mother, felt pressure to be a perfect parent, to do no wrong, and to have perfect children. As a result, we had to be perfectly behaved when we were out in public, because if we weren't, Mom was really worried that Child Protective Services would take us away. Because she was blind, she couldn't be a good mother.
That vulnerability had to be on her mind all the time then.
All the time. Right. We always had to, we had 3 different kinds of clothes. One for school, then we came home and changed into play clothes that we could get dirty, and then one was for Sunday. And she was very worried about her own clothing. I don't know many other children who have memories of their mother saying, do I look all right? Or do I have any spots on me? Is my lipstick on straight? Yeah, no, Mom, you're fine. You're fine. Let's go. You know, I'd always be in a hurry. she was just wanting to make sure everything was right, because she knew that people would be saying, well, how does that blind lady take care of those kids?
Yes. Was she subject to being bullied at all in the adult community, do you think?
Okay, she was bullied as a child from other sighted kids who would tease her and do things, make play tricks on her. But as far as adults go, it was more subtle. There was a story my sister told of riding on the bus, going down to a doctor's office or something, and there were some women that were talking about my mother. How does she do that? And they were talking about her behind her back. My mother could hear it. So if you consider that bullying, yeah, I guess in a way it was. But, and I said, it's more subtle, more behind her back, more people talking about her. And she knew people were talking about her, of course.
How long did it take you to write the book?
Over 10 years. It's a massive story. I could have written a whole book just about my dad, or one just about my mom, or one about them as a couple, what they've done, or one about the whole family. And I was like, how do I tell this story? Probably six different drafts. And I had a writing group and they were very helpful with making suggestions and so forth. But yeah, once I figured out how to tell it, boom, it took off.
Yeah. So it was all in there. It's just a matter of getting it onto the page. Now, you have Braille numbers are used at the beginning of each chapter instead of...
just for fun.
Yeah, good for you. This has been an incredibly intriguing conversation. I want to ask a couple more questions before we wrap things up. How did you end up in Houston?
I married my child high school sweetheart, and we were living in North Carolina at the time when he said came home and said, well, I'm being recruited to go to Houston. So I'm like, oh, I don't want to go to Houston. No desire to go to Houston. And at that time, my parents were living just a couple miles away from us. So I really hated to leave them behind and taking my third granddaughter. But I did, and I was there for 43 years. And then my partner and I decided that it'd be more fun to live in Colorado Springs. So 3 weeks ago, we moved into a house in Colorado Springs.
3 weeks ago. That's great. And yeah. and your parents ended up in Houston as well. So,
yes, they did. We were always worried. My siblings and I would be talking on the phone for a long time. It's about what we do when mom and dad get older, because together they were a perfect team. Mom did all the cooking. Dad enjoyed things, took care of some stuff, but dad couldn't take care of himself. He couldn't cook for himself. And he wouldn't know how to take care of my mom if she got sick. So I said, why don't you just come down to Houston? And they did. But it was interesting when they came in, they were in assisted living, refused any help with anything. They could do it just fine themselves.
Of course.
Absolutely. They wanted to take their own medicine. They didn't want anybody to touch their medicine. They couldn't do it themselves. They went down to their meals by themselves and got around just fine. It came to be a point where mom got really, really sick. And then when she passed, and dad, of course, was by himself. And that's when I decided, my life became really intertwined with dad's, because I'd quit my job before him because I knew that they would require a lot of attention. But we took dad on trips. He loved to go. We went everywhere. We took him to Belize, and we took him to Utah. We took him to Rocky Mountains, wherever, California. We went all over the place, and he loved it. He would sit there and just say, this air smells so good, so fresh. And that's circling back to when he first moved to Houston. This assisted living place had windows you could open, but it was so hot. And it was constant air conditioning noise. It almost drove me nuts because I didn't have anywhere to go outside and enjoy the fresh air. Yes, you can sit outside, but you hear the humming of the air conditioners all over, and it's really hot and humid. So I felt really bad. So I would take him places and bring him to my house, and we would go swimming in the pool and you know, that kind of stuff. So I kept him busy. And that's one reason why I wanted to put in a little bit about later life, because it ties up so neatly, and I'm not going to ruin a surprise. But let me just say that when my dad first heard her voice, it was in fourth grade when mom was reciting a poem. My father had that memorized and remembered it when he was 92 and at his very last doctor appointment. He said, her voice just comforted me all my life when I was alone or lonely. And that just almost brought me to tears.
Of course it did.
So it's a love story as well as, wow, how did they do this?
Let's round the corner and say, and the first sentence of the book is, my parents had no idea what I looked like.
Yeah, they didn't know what each other looked like.
Well, it's been a delight talking with you today. And your website and any method of communication that you'd like to share is?
My website is Mary P, as in Paul, Harper, HARPER.com. I can give you my email address now. It's Mary@MaryPHarper.com.
The book is The Sound of Her Voice, My Blind Parent's Story, written by Mary Harper. Mary Harper, thank you very, very much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed our interview with Mary Harper and her wonderful and inspirational story about her parents. The book is titled, The Sound of Her Voice, My Blind Parents' Story. The book is available on Amazon and soon will be available on Audible. The current audio version can be heard very soon on Sight into Sound's Morning Book Hour. You can visit Mary's website at marypharper.com and her email is mary
at marypharper.com. And you can also find her on Facebook and Instagram. If you would like to hear this program again, just visit our podcast page at sightindosound.org. Your producer was Jim Martinez. I'm Jim Bratton. Sight Into Sound Presents is a production of Sight Into Sound Radio, Houston, Texas.